Welcome to the MacArthur Memorial Podcast. I'm your host, Amanda Williams. Join me as we explore the life and legacy of General of the Army Douglas MacArthur and discuss a wide range of military history topics from the American Civil War to the Korean War. In February 2024, the MacArthur Memorial hosted an event to mark the 125th anniversary of the Philippine-American War. This event was in partnership with the Hampton Roads chapter of the Filipino-American National Historical Society and the Council of United Filipino Organizations of Tidewater. The event featured presentations by several scholars on different aspects of the war. This episode features a lecture by Dr. Brian Lin on the U.S. Army and the Philippine-American War.
Our first presenter today is Dr. Brian Lin. Dr. Lin is the Ralph R. Thomas Professor in Liberal Arts at Texas A&M, and he's the author of numerous books, including The Philippine War, 1899 to 1902, and The U.S. Army and Counterinsurgency in the Philippine War, 1899 to 1902. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Lin.
Thanks very much to Amanda, James Zobel, Jennifer, the invitation, MacArthur Memorial Foundation for hosting this event. As I was preparing this talk, I recognized the problems inherent in compressing research I began in 1979, before any of you were born, into about a 20-minute talk. So I'm going to apologize if I either say too little or too much, but I hope at the end you'll share some of my interest, enthusiasm in the experience of the American soldier in the Philippines. I have a very simple thesis that I'm going to expound on today, which is that for about 120 years, the American soldier in the Philippines has been a victim of a gross historical misinterpretation initiated by anti-imperialists and continued by ideologues, all too many of them who bear academic credentials. College textbooks have indoctrinated people for generations in a gruesome story of a racist, brutal, near-genocidal American soldiery suppressing a Philippine independence movement and wreaking havoc on defenseless civilians. Almost invariably, these authors assert U.S. troop behavior can be typified by a line from a song, one line, "Civilize them with a crag," a reference to the Krag Jorgensen rifle. In many ways, this is as bad a stereotype as those that the Vietnam veterans have endured. It's four or five generations now. It's a fundamental problem with this. Textbook version has continued despite being repudiated by scholars in both the United States and the Philippines. And let us leave aside the fact that many American soldiers were not equipped with Krag Jorgensen rifles. We'll leave aside also that the first reference that I've ever found to this song is actually after the war in 1902, so that the soldiers at the time were probably not singing it. Or would anyone in the audience like to be typecast for some heavy metal or country western blues ballad that they screamed out when they were teenagers for the rest of their lives? Let's turn to practical matters. Even had they not wanted to, preponderance of evidence suggests, and by the way, that they did not, how could a force of between 26,000 and 46,000 effective soldiers inflict such a precise number of casualties on an enemy that was conducting guerrilla warfare in the jungles, rice paddies, and in the grasslands? And if we want to be brutally frank, this interpretation casts those who so courageously resisted American colonization, people such as Miguel Melvar, Juan Calles, the Fillmore brothers, and so forth, as little more than passive victims. And it's a derogatory to both the American soldiers and to those who resisted them. Now, without in any way criticizing my hosts, I think it's useful, since I'm talking about the betrayal of the American soldier, to talk about how the war is betrayed. This is a wonderful painting that appears on your program. Unfortunately, it's purely the creation of an artist's imagination, probably from about 8,000 miles away. There was never an engagement where immaculate lines of khaki-colored Americans charged equally immaculately dressed Filipino revolutionary soldiers. Similarly, the drawing of American soldiers marching through Caloocan in the 10th of February, 6 days after the war began, I've often seen used as a reference to the property destruction campaigns 2.5 years later. Who actually was responsible for burning Caloocan is still probably debated, but it's a sad fact of all urban combat that, in fact, when people get into fighting in cities, property destruction and burning occurs. It has nothing often to do with the motives of the people involved. That photograph at the extreme is actually true, but it was taken in the February or March 1899 when American soldiers were actually in large formations. And as you can see, posing in a trench. This is an actual picture of what campaigning in the Philippines was like. Handful of soldiers patrolling in the boondocks, a word that actually comes out of the Philippines, plodding through swamp, high grass, no fancy uniforms, no horses, and in fact, no enemy in sight. That's combat in the Philippines. It's one of the few pictures we have past the big unit battles of 1899. And you can see it's a small group of soldiers somewhere on a rice paddy, having taken fire, perhaps a sniper taking off a single shot. They're trying to see who it was. They're so immune to danger that two of them are standing up there trying to see what, who's out there and who's shooting at us. How would they know if they hit anything? Though I wouldn't be surprised to find out that they did. Yeah, we shot at least five of them. So you can get an idea why I'm so skeptical about these precise casualty figures. This will be no surprise to any person. It could apply to people that served in World War II or Korea or Vietnam or Iraq. Any effort to pigeonhole the U.S. soldier and reduce their experience to a few stereotypes, such as civilizing with a crag, is simply ridiculous because so much of this is dependent on so many variables. When you were there, where you were there, who you were dealing with. You know, whether you're up in the top of New Luzon, or you're down in the Visayas, or you're on Samar, which is a different place, and so forth. You know, it's all dependent. The other thing that we have to remember is that there are three different armies. The experience of the U.S. soldier depends on what army they were in. The first, and the one pictured in the majority of the photos, and the one responsible for the acquisition of the Proclamation of Independence, were the U.S. With the volunteers raised to fight against Spain in 1898. They thought they were going to go liberate Cuba. And I tell you, they were quite shocked to find themselves being sent across the ocean to fight a very different type of war. And they were even more unhappy to find that they were staying there to fight another enemy. Whether it's true or not, one of my beliefs is the reason that it was called the Philippine Insurrection was that most of these people were militia. And there's only three reasons the militia can be deployed into federal service. One of them is insurrection. So this sort of legal fiction that this was an insurrection allowed them to retain these people in uniform long after they should have been sent home. This is their area of operations, which is central Luzon. And they rarely never went out of that. There's one regiment in Negros, but beyond that, this is their experience in the Philippines, Manila area in central Luzon. These are the people that fight the major conventional battles against the Army of the Revolution or Emilio Aguinaldo's forces. But they are withdrawn. The next unit is one I find most interesting are the U.S. volunteers. These are troops that were raised precisely for and limited to service in the Philippines. For 2 years tour of duty, these are the ones whose job is occupation, pacification, extending U.S. colonial war. They're the ones that fight the bulk of the counterinsurgency campaign. And I'll be talking about one of these regiments later. That's their area of operations. So when you speak about Filipinos to people who were there in 1899, the state volunteers, you're talking primarily in the Tagalog region. But these people encounter everybody. They're up in the Ilocano region all the way down to the Moro region. And so when what Filipinos did they encounter? Depends on where they were. Some were in provinces where there was enormously organized very tough resistance. People in Laguna province, people in the Pangas province, people in, others were in very peaceful areas where there was almost no resistance. So what experience did they have? Depends. The last army is the U.S. Army. Now, there were U.S. Army regular units deployed from the beginning, but as any of the volunteers will tell you, they stayed in Manila. We were the ones who did the fighting. In fact, they were deployed all over the place, but in much smaller groups. They did not really become the majority of the troops until June 1901. Those are the ones that fight those last controversial campaigns and are usually the ones that are accused of, and with good reason at sometimes, of atrocities, war crimes, torture, and so forth. Okay. They had a very different experience as well. The other thing we have to remember is the textbook version of American soldiers having really no other purpose beyond brutally suppressing a movement for independence ignores that their mission was to impose colonial government. I always like this picture, and I like the one that follows. That's General Elwell Otis. And for all the ones who are in the military, that's his staff. That's what he's running the war on. Right now, we have the equivalent of, what, two divisions in the Pentagon? So when you talk about, you know, orders coming down from Manila and central control, and this is a policy, you know, he never goes out. How would he know what people are doing out there? He has no way. Some places it took 3 months for an order to arrive. The people on the front to say, this really doesn't fit our situation. You know, I obey, but I don't comply. Send it back. And 3 months later, we'd get in Manila. So as with General Douglas MacArthur in Japan, it's important to remember that the United States Army in the Philippines has both military and governing duties. It's responsible for both. He serves as governor and as military commander. And those responsibilities go down parallel all the way to the lowest post commander. This is a period that to me is much more interesting. And I think the one that often gets ignored, which is sort of the count, but later on, 2006 was rediscovered as counterinsurgency. But the primary job here is imposing government. And to give you an idea of that, I've got a long quotation from J. Franklin Bell. J. Franklin Bell was, with all apologies to Frederick Funston, the number one or number two combat officer in the Philippines. Guy who won a Medal of Honor, and anyone who's a veteran of the U.S. Army will appreciate this, went from lieutenant to brigadier general in little more than 2 years. Okay. Talk about promotion for merit. He is describing what he is doing on a day-to-day basis as commander of the 5th District Department of Northern Luzon. And I think when you look at that, you'll see that combat is one of, it actually doesn't really talk about it. This is what I'm having to do. Okay? It is a governing mission. And I think that is often sort of ignored in much of this. Now, it is this effort that's opposed because there are people who are already there who are governing their own towns and own provinces. So this is in many ways what sparks resistance. There's sort of two levels of resistance. There's resistance against Aguinaldo's government, you know, by Aguinaldo's republic. But once it disperses, the war becomes much more local. And in some cases, it's very fragmented. I'm speaking about groups like Papa Isio's, Babylon's group, the Negros, or the Dio Dios on Samar, or the Guardia Honor in Union province, with Calorums in Batangas. But the most successful resistance movements established a parallel infrastructure, if you will. It was having local government, and sometimes under the very noses of that American garrison, with its own mayor, its own police force, its own tax collection office, and so forth, running parallel, and often the same people having these dual responsibilities. And it was extremely frustrating because you couldn't separate the resistance from the Americanistas, the people who were supporting. And this is where you get into the role of General Arthur MacArthur, General Douglas MacArthur's father. Again, that's him with his staff too. So, just in my rude and cynical way, when I was asked how the United States could do better in Iraq and Afghanistan, I said, well, you should look at the staff.
if you get all those other people out in the field. But he recognizes that that occupation policy that Otis had set up with government isn't working, because you can't impose government if too many people are either willingly or unwillingly resisting it with armed force. So he seeks to continue those governing policies, but also with more repressive armed sanctions. And one of the measures he takes, interesting enough, as here in the former Confederacy, is General Orders 100, issued in 1863, which was used by Union Army forces to impose order on the former Confederacy. It's a law about how to govern under military occupation. And he established very strict sanctions. And it's those measures, the continuation of sort of civil government, civic action, and more repressive measures against these areas that are still being resistant, and a very generous conciliation policy, which allowed former guerrilla leaders to surrender. And in some cases, in the case of Manuel Pino and Juan Cayas, to become immediately officials in the American government. The Billmore brothers, too, in the Ilocos, you know, like, surrender. And oh, by the way, you're now the assistant governor, which was a good conciliation policy. And I think it had some certain applications that Douglas MacArthur did also in Japan. It's, you know, the war is over. It is time to forget those hostilities. But that means by the fall of 1901, resistance was largely confined to a few areas. And in some areas, fighting for reasons that had only tangential relations to the original reasons for fighting. Okay, so I'm going to talk very briefly. You know, having said that no unit was typical, I'm going to talk about an atypical unit. But this was their experience. This is the 33rd Infantry U.S. Volunteers, and they were assigned to Ilocos Norte, Ilocos Sur, in Abra Province. 1,200 people to govern three provinces with a population of about 500,000 people. And these was their civic action things, setting up schools, building up the infrastructure, reestablishing trade, building roads, setting up markets, and so forth. These are the number of engagements they had. Now, an engagement was any time you took fire. So those troops out on the rice paddy, that constitutes an engagement. Doesn't mean a battle, okay? But you can see how it goes up and down. And if I could do a breakdown, and I did this when I did the research, of individual company units, you'd find that a unit in one town, like Candon, is suddenly getting a lot of resistance, but another town, like in Vigan, had none at all. And it fluctuates back and forth. And I always said that if you could get two people from the same regiment at a bar, so, well, you know, what are you doing? Oh, it's really peaceful. We're getting shot at all the time. Everyone hates it. Oh, you know, these people are really friendly. What's wrong with you? And so, you know, just totally different experiences. That's a number of fatalities. And again, in one case, I'm pretty sure October, that represents one engagement. And that was the only engagement that Company F took in the entire appearance of counterinsurgency. But it was a very costly one. But it also supports the thing I'm trying to show you about combat in the Philippines. It's scattered. It's a few soldiers usually taking long range fire, and seldom do you have any big battles. Well, you've seen a couple of pictures of artistic portrayals. What's interesting is when the soldiers, if you look at the pictures, the soldiers actually took of themselves. It's them marching around, and it's them interacting with their people. People that they're garrisoning. Okay. You have to remember, there wasn't a lot to do. And so they spent a lot of time in the market. They learned a sort of pidgin dialect called bamboo. And they sort of, that's where they had to spend their money. So they spent a lot of time interacting, staring at people, you know, in the marketplace, still popular, and taking pictures with people, often children, that they had sort of adopted. So this is what the soldier's image of themselves is. And you can see it contrasts very graphically with the picture of people in uniform charging and so forth. So these are the sort of final thoughts. First of all, everything you read in your textbook is probably wrong, but that shouldn't surprise any of you. There's no common sequence. But someone says, oh, this is a common, typical experience. Clearly, no, they don't know what they're talking about. I find the term benevolent assimilation as ironic as many people in the audience did. But it is the policy, okay? And whether you accept it or not, this is an effort to impose colonial government by force. Okay? It is not simply soldiers running amok, another word we get from Malay, and creating havoc. There is a purpose behind it that ultimately was successful. Whether it could have been done with far less cost or whether it should have been done at all is not something I'm qualified to discuss. I'm just interested in how it got happened. And probably this is the most misunderstood conflict American soldiers have ever fought, though I recognize that the Vietnam veterans will probably take exception to that. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. If you have questions, suggestions, or comments, we want to hear from you. You can find us on Twitter at MacArthur1880, on Facebook as the General Douglas MacArthur Memorial, or you can email MacArthurMemorial@norfolk.gov.